Thanks for tuning in for the November 23rd podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Patricia Poso-Rosich about the International Headache Society and European Headache Federation's 2021 Joint International Headache Congress. This week's feature interview is with Dr. Jan Roos, and it will focus on the association of speech phenotype and levodopa responsiveness in patients with newly diagnosed Parkinson's disease.
Hi, I'm Tisha Manteeth from the Neurology Podcast. With me today is Patricia Poso-Rosich, a neurologist in charge of headache and craniofacial pain clinic and the director of Migraine Adaptive Brain Center at the Hall de Bron University Hospital in Barcelona, Spain. She was one of the scientific program chairs of the International Headache Congress that occurred in September. Hi, Patricia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tisha, for the kind invitation.
Can you tell us a little bit about the scientific debates? They always tell us where we are as a field.
To put them in some order, but not in a hierarchy or anything, I would say that one topic that we are probably starting to see the light upon is on how to treat medication overuse. We had different views on whether if it was better just to do a more Scandinavian approach on, you know, detoxifying, but not perhaps starting initially a preventive treatment, on what to do if we already start a preventive treatment at the beginning. So what's the role of education there? What's the role of prevention? And I think that we are coming, I would say, to a nice place now in the headache world where most clinicians and researchers agree upon how we should properly treat these patients in need, which probably part of what is happening in their behavior has to do with the severity of the disease that they're suffering from.
I was just going to comment for those that weren't at the meeting that starting prevention early, not necessarily waiting to withdraw patients or doing both at the same time, that there are a number of options that may be useful depending on the patient's presentation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So nowadays, I would say that we value education a lot, but we also understand that we need to start treating these patients appropriately already from the beginning because we have realized, I think, that the outcomes are better. Then the next, I think, probably issue that we have in migraine is understanding the impact of hormones in the brain. Migraine being such a, you know, female prevalent, you could say, or focused, you could say, almost disease. And also knowing that when we have done genome-wide genetics, you know, so genome-wide analysis, when we study all of the genome and see that the polymorphisms, so the changes in our DNA that are linked with migraine have not to do with hormones, we want to understand and start, I think, focusing more on better understanding the impact that hormones might have on the brain and why is that then linked or not to headache or migraine. And I think the prolactin new hormone, I would say, as like new kid on the block hormone, you know, with the research done actually from Mayo Clinic and from Greg Dussor's lab, I think was very insightful. And I'm sure it will trigger, you know, future studies and future interest in better understanding the roles of hormones in migraine.
I was going to mention how important hormones are, but you had also spoke about the COVID talks. And I know you've did a lot of work in COVID.
My main message, you know, in relation to COVID is that headache should be considered by all specialists, not only neurologists and headache specialists, because it is a sign, a symptom that can help us understand the impact that other diseases have in our brain and organism, so our bodies, and make us better understand also how to address symptoms that can become and are very disabling. So that is the main message. And then I would say that, you know, what comes out from this is that we realized already at the beginning of the pandemic that headache was an important symptom that appeared with COVID, and that for some patients it was their almost main symptom. And that is one learning. The second big learning is that it seems that when you have headache, COVID might be less severe, and be related to less mortality. And I think that might be also interesting, and we will confirm this with time. And the third big concept is that we need to treat headache also and not think that it is normal to have a headache because you have an infectious disease or maybe even fever, because sometimes it is not. And actually, it helps us understand the impact of how, in this case, this SARS coronavirus 2 is affecting our bodies.
Those are all great points. What about the new emerging therapies for migraine, mainly the CGRP monoclonal antibodies and the GPANs?
I do think that there are several key important also messages. The first one is that having a biological treatment that actually is helping clinically, in a meaningful clinical way, our patients, I think grounds migraine as a true disease. And that is very important to understand. You know, we have now more knowledge on what is going on in migraine, which are the important neuropeptides involved. And you mentioned CGRP, but also PACAP or VIP, VIP. And maybe having, you know, understanding what each peptide does is not as important for a general neurologist, but I do think it is important to understand that there are peptides that are very linked to the disease, and that by treating them or modulating their effect, we actually are clinically helping our patients. And then the next thing I would say is that these drugs seem to be very well tolerated. The level of adherence is much higher than what we had seen before, and that the clinical outcomes that we are seeing in real life exceed expectations from the results that we were finding in clinical trials. And I think all of these messages are very positive for clinicians and especially our patients, because it gives us more tools to be able to help those who suffer.
That's absolutely true. And I really appreciate the fact that some of these biologics are useful even in those that have failed multiple prophylactic therapies.
Exactly. That's another very important point to mention, that they are working in people who have failed even 7 therapies. We see this in real life. People who are overusing medication, people who have failed Botox, people who have other comorbidities. So actually, you're right. They are proving to be, you know, as I said, they exceed expectations. I think they're proving to be very useful. And now I think it's the time to provide appropriate access to those in need.
Well, I agree with you there. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for the invitation.
And this is Tisha Manteeth. Thank you for listening.
Hi, it's Jeff Ratliff with Thomas Jefferson University and the Neurology Podcast. For this week's featured article interview, I'm speaking with Jan Rusch, a PhD researcher in the Department of Neurology at Charles University in Prague and associate professor in the Faculty of Electrical Engineering at the Czech Technical University. Jan is the lead author on a paper in this week's issue of Neurology titled Defining Speech Subtypes in De Novo Parkinson's Disease, Response to Long-Term Levodopa Therapy. In this study, Jan and colleagues recorded speech data from 111 Parkinson's disease patients and used cluster analysis to help define subtypes of speech disturbances. They subsequently went on to explore clinical associations with these speech subtypes, including their response to levodopa therapy. So Jan, our listeners will either recall from their training or even from their own practice seeing patients with Parkinson's disease that disturbances in speech are a common manifestation of Parkinson's. And I'll admit even before that I tended to lump all speech disturbances together as hypophonia or softness of speech, but certainly as I think about it, as with many clinical manifestations of Parkinson's, there's more nuance and variability from patient to patient. So coming into this study, what did we already know about the types of speech disturbances seen in patients with Parkinson's disease?
Well, you are correct. Although we can say that general patterns of hypokinetic dysarthria in patients with Parkinson's disease are somehow uniform, there is still a huge variability of speech deficits from patient to patient, as you said. I also agree that hypophonia or softness of speech represents the most characteristic feature of dysarthria. According to most influential studies that existing, which are based on a sample of 200 patients in various stages of Parkinson's disease, dysphonia, such as harshness or breathiness, was considered as a leading deficit. And this was followed by imprecise articulation of consonants and vowels, and then by fluency deficits. This means inappropriate pauses, repetition of syllables, and these are obvious mainly in more severe stages of disease. However, no specific speech phenotypes were defined up until now. So one of the reasons might be that most what we currently know about character and of speech disturbances came from advanced or mixed stages of Parkinson's disease. And in our new study, we focused on speech disorders in newly diagnosed patients before the introduction of dopaminergic treatment.
Understood. So like you said, there's some speech disturbances that are more harshness of speech or more breathy qualities of speech, but then we can probably think of examples of other speech phenotypes where there's more palatalia or articulation deficits that our patients may have. But really up until now, while we may be aware of those clinically, they haven't really been well defined in the literature. And in your introduction, you outlined that the pendulum in the literature has really swung back and forth a little bit on whether these speech disturbances in Parkinson's are responsive to dopamine therapy, specifically looking at levodopa. So moving on to your study itself, it looks like you took these factors into account. So first noting what we talked about, that there is variability of speech phenotypes and speech patterns in Parkinson's, and then also noting that there's variability in what degree of improvement we will see in those speech disturbances when we initiate therapy like levodopa. So in your study, you went on to use acoustic analysis to try and define speech subtypes in Parkinson's. Given the subtle differences in these speech subtypes, this acoustic analysis allows you to really objectively sort of record and evaluate them along these different axes, and then do cluster analysis to figure out how they group themselves and differentiate themselves, and then look at how they respond to therapy. And so given those methods, what did you find? What did the acoustic recording and subsequent analysis show us about trying to define speech subtypes in Parkinson's disease?
Mm-hmm. Yes, our findings are pretty straightforward. So we were able to define three distinct speech subtypes which have similar prevalence, similar symptom duration, and similar motor severity.
And so with these defined speech subtypes, and some of them have common features common to all of them, but then others might have more imprecise articulation versus other subtypes with more harshness of speech. And so now that you've defined these three subtypes, did those clusters offer clues towards the clinical manifestation in these patients' Parkinson's diseases themselves, perhaps either with other associated clinical symptoms or signs, or as we've talked about already a little bit, in their response to treatment?
Indeed, we observed interesting associations here. So as a result, it seems that levodopa therapy ameliorates mainly voice quality, that is a harsh voice, but improvement in intonation was also notable. So in other words, we can say that levodopa mainly improves speech abnormalities associated with laryngeal rigidity. However, it should be noted that this improvement of phonatory prosodic subtype detected by acoustic analysis resulted in only small perceptual improvement. This is somehow expected as severity of dysarthria in newly diagnosed patients is generally very mild.
And so I want to take this analysis and these subtypes into clinic again, so to speak. So there's the prosodic subtype, the phonatory prosodic subtype, and the articulatory prosodic subtype. And in listening to patients and talking with our patients, I want to hear a little bit from you, if possible, are these subtypes that we can detect by listening to patients at the bedside? What do these patterns sound like to our human ears rather than using the more computational acoustic analysis that you all did?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for this question. This is a very good question. So despite that we used somehow a specialized acoustic assessment, I believe that these speech subtypes can be perceptually detected by clinicians, or our experience is that we can detect it by perception as well. The first monotone speech with potentially softer voice can be found in every subtype. And the difference is for these two later subtypes. So for phonatory prosodic subtypes, perceptual difference is that patients manifest more harshness or breathiness, but articulation is still distinct. For articulatory prosodic subtype, speech does not need to be harsh, but it's already slightly slurred. So you can hear that some consonants and vowels are already not articulated properly, and the speech starts to be slightly less intelligible.
Got it. Okay, so everybody has the monotonic or mono-loud sort of characteristics, but the phonatory prosodic subtype, they're going to have relatively normal articulation, but there's going to be an added harshness to the speech, where the articulatory prosodic subtype, they don't necessarily have the harsh speech, but they have a deficits in consonant articulation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so once we hopefully have been able to train our ears to try and make some of those distinctions, hopefully with some practice, and our listeners can think about some of these subtypes as they see patients after listening to us, the big question is this going to have an impact on how we either counsel or prognosticate the response to levodopa for our patients? If we can detect these subtypes, does that change the conversation we have when initiating therapy or when talking to patients and families about anticipating things like gait impairment or cognitive impairment that you mentioned with the articulatory subtype?
Yes, this is also a very good question, and I believe so. Based on our study, we already know that those patients who already have harsh voice will likely improve. This is the one point. But on the other hand, I believe that speech performance may give us clues for more distant prognostication. As you said, for instance, our articulatory prosodic subtype had more cognitive dysfunction, which likely points out already to more widespread neurodegeneration. So we can imagine that speech can give us insight not only about the response to therapy, but also about the risk of development of more disabling cognitive or motor impairment. So for example, in future research, we would like to focus on the risk factor of development of palilalia, which is one of the most disabling speech symptoms in Parkinson's disease.
So if we have patients who have this more harsh voice type and we're initiating levodopa therapy, maybe in that conversation, we can say that maybe there's a better chance that their voice is going to respond to that levodopa therapy. On the flip side, a patient who has more of this articulation deficit subtype of speech, we're on the lookout for a syndrome that has more gait impairment, cognitive impairment, some of the really more disabling symptoms that patients and families should be on the lookout for.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I'm really looking forward to having these subtypes fleshed out more and to work you just alluded to on palilalia and some other speech disturbances in Parkinson's patients. And I want to thank you, Jan, for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you again for your invitation. It was a great opportunity to talk with you.
I've been speaking with Jan Rusch, a PhD researcher from Charles University and at the Czech Technical University in Prague. You've been listening to the Neurology Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, some exciting news to announce. In early 2022, the AAN is launching the Brain and Life podcast. It'll be dedicated to educating the general public through interviews with celebrities, public figures, and health experts. If you've always wanted a side gig in audio or radio, here's your opportunity. The AAN is seeking two AAN members to serve as hosts for the weekly podcast. If you're interested, go to aan.com/BL podcast host. That's aan.com/BL podcast host, and make sure to apply by the December 1st deadline.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which includes an article that describes the prevalence of patent foramen ovale, or PFO, in children with cryptogenic arterial ischemic stroke, as well as a review on the use of large-scale data sharing and artificial intelligence to monitor the progression of multiple sclerosis using MRI. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.